On this 15th day of August 2011 in San Diego, we are reading from the Srimad Bhagavad Gita as it is, translation and commentary by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. We are in Chapter 3 entitled Karma Yoga, and we are in text number 35. Shreyan Swadharmo Vigunam Padadharmat Swanushtitat Swadharme Dadanam Shreya Padadharmo Vayabaha Shreyan Swadharmo Vigunah Padadharmat Swanushtitat Swadharme Dadanam Shreya Padadharmo Vayabaha. It is far better to discharge one's prescribed duties, even though faultily, than another's duties perfectly. Destruction in the course of performing one's own duty is better than engaging in another's duties, for to follow another's path is dangerous. Purport. One should therefore discharge his prescribed duties in full Krishna consciousness, rather than those prescribed for others. Materially, prescribed duties are duties enjoined according to one's psychophysical condition, under the spell of the modes of material nature. Spiritual duties are as ordered by the spiritual master for the transcendental service of Krishna. But whether material or spiritual, one should stick to his prescribed duties even up to death, rather than imitate another's prescribed duties. Duties on the spiritual platform and duties on the material platform may be different, but the principle of following the authorized direction is always good for the performer. When one is under the spell of the modes of material nature, one should follow the prescribed rules for his particular situation and should not imitate others. For example, a Brahmin who is in the mode of goodness is nonviolent, whereas a Kshatriya who is in the mode of passion is allowed to be violent. As such, for a Kshatriya, it is better to be vanquished following the rules of violence than to imitate a Brahmin who follows the principles of nonviolence. Everyone has to cleanse his heart by a gradual process, not abruptly. However, when one transcends the modes of material nature and is fully situated in Krishna consciousness, he can perform anything and everything under the direction of a bona fide spiritual master. In that complete stage of Krishna consciousness, the Kshatriya may act as a Brahmin, or a Brahmin may act as a Kshatriya. In the transcendental stage, the distinctions of the material world do not apply. For example, Vishvamitra was originally a Kshatriya, but later on he acted as a Brahmin, whereas Parashuram was a Brahmin, but later on he acted as a Kshatriya. Being transcendentally situated, they could do so. But as long as one is on the material platform, he must perform his duties according to the modes of material nature. At the same time, he must have a full sense of Krishna consciousness. Om jnanatam anandasya jnanandana shalakaya chakshu unmilatam mena tasmai shri gurave namaha. I was born in the darkness of ignorance. My spiritual master Srila Prabhupada opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge. I offer my humble obeisances unto him and all members of Sri Parampara. So, this word suanushtitat, which is pronounced here swanushtitat, the U becomes a V. This appears twice in the second chapter of the first canto of Bhagavatam, this word. And both times are instructive for us. Now, in that second chapter of the first canto, Suta Goswami is speaking about the supreme dharma. The supreme dharma, of course, is that which awakens pure devotional service to Krishna. In this particular section, Krishna is not speaking about the supreme dharma so much as the swadharma. Swadharma, in this instance, refers to dharma which is especially suited to one's psychophysical nature. In other words, being a kshatriya, being a brahmin, kshatriya being a warrior or administrator, or a brahmin being an intellectual, learned soul, is not intrinsically spiritual. It's not intrinsically spiritual. There are people who are marshal who are very good at managing things, who are not spiritual at all. But in the Varnashram system, it's meant, which is Brahmins, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudras, or intellectuals and martial or managerial people, those who are Vaishyas, who produce poo. That's it over here. Sorry. The farmers, merchants, bankers, and the manual laborers. Society is organized in such a way that it gradually draws everyone toward Krishna consciousness. So it's very clear in that second chapter, showing where we are, that whatever you do is ultimately useless unless it brings about attraction to Krishna. So this word suanushtitat, which means, as we see here, perfectly done. So it says, what is it? Dharma sanushtitat punksam vishrukshena katasuyat notpadiya jadirutim shamevikim. Thank you. So dharma suanushtitat punksam. If a person does his dharma very nicely, but it doesn't awaken attraction for the message of Krishna, then it's called shama evihi kevalam, which means just a waste of time. And then later on, atak pumbhu dvidasresha varnashram varnashram vibhagshaha swanusitasya dharmasa sangsidhi haritoshinam. So the divisions of varna and ashram, also the ashram, the brahmachari, the grihastha, the vanaprastha sannyasi, or the student life, the household life, retired life, and renounced life, that also only has meaning as long as it's centered on Krishna for the satisfaction of Krishna. Sangsiddhi haritoshana means it's perfected by satisfying Krishna. Now, in this particular verse, Krishna is talking about, you know, beginning the process. This karma yoga is the first yoga on the yoga ladder. It's like a yoga ladder. It takes one from karma yoga, jnana yoga, the yoga of developing knowledge, transcendental knowledge, ashtanga yoga, or meditative yoga, dhyana yoga, and finally bhakti yoga. And bhakti yoga really includes all the others. Bhakti yoga is the perfect karma yoga, jnana yoga, and meditative yoga combined. So here in this, the first stage, one should stick with one's swadharma. Now, the idea is that society needs to be organized nicely. For otherwise, if everyone is trying to do other people's dharma, things get chaotic, right? And in a chaotic situation, nobody can advance. So for the benefit of oneself and for society at large, one should find one's place in society according to your psychophysical nature and act in that way rather than, you know, trying to be something you're not, you know, which can cause havoc in your own life and others. So that's what Krishna is saying here. But as Prabhupada points out, at a certain point, if one is ready to fully immerse oneself in Krishna consciousness, then swadharma takes a back seat. And that's why Narada Muni says to Vyasadeva in his instructions on the writing of Bhagavatam, you know, that, what is that? Don't tell me. He says, Chaktva Swadharmam, but Swaktvata Dharmam, Sharanam Bhajam Kareya, Bhajan Napakvo Tapate Tato Yidi, Yatra Kavabhadram, Abuddha Mushikim Kovarta Apto Abhajatam Swadharmata. So if someone gives up his Swadharma and takes up full time bhakti yoga, because really bhakti yoga is beyond the Swadharma because it's beyond the material platform, it's directly the soul acting. One may be engaged according to his psychophysical nature, but then again, one may not be. You know, there's the same famous phrase Prabhupada introduced, you know, do the needful, do the needful. So someone joins up, he may be a doctor, you know, or a pre-med, or with another person, maybe, whatever. But the floor has to be cleaned, the pots have to be washed, you know, the chanting has to be done. This is all beyond Swadharma. You do whatever is necessary. And so, in this case, Narada Muni says, if someone gives up his role in Varnashram and takes fully the Krishna consciousness, but then doesn't complete the course, he does a little bit, but then it's called yoga brashta. His yoga is broken and deviate. Where is there any loss? There's no loss. Because Krishna says very clearly in the last chapter, there is no loss or diminution in this process. Because whatever you do in Krishna consciousness stays with you. It stays with the soul. Everything else materially stays with the body. You can't take it with you. But what you can take with you is your consciousness. So, but and then on the other hand, he says, Yatra kvavabha dhrambhunamushikim kovata apto abhajatam swadharmataha. The person who follows the Swadharma but doesn't worship Krishna, where is there any gain? You see? So ultimately, Swadharma is not the final arbiter or criterion for action in this world. But it's important also in Krishna consciousness, especially in the early stages, that we find a service that complements us. And this is where the spiritual master comes in, one's authorities, and sees how, oh, this person is suited to, you know, do brahminical work. This person, you know, is better doing heavy, you know, physical work. That doesn't matter, you know. The idea is that any society, either a microcosmic society like a temple or a larger society like a city, if Krishna is in the center, then everyone is satisfied with his role to play. Just like in the spiritual world, you know, the living entities are naturally situated according not to the Swadharma, but according to their rasa, according to their true nature in relationship to Krishna. And so it's not like the cows are envious of the gopis, because they get, you know, and the cow boys are envious of Mother Yashoda, because everyone's situated nicely. It's all very harmonious. It's almost inconceivable in this world where there's so much chaos and so much struggle and no one is satisfied, to imagine a world where everyone is satisfied. That's called Vaikuntha. No anxiety. Anxiety comes because you're not properly situated, you lose something, you know, like that, whatever. So that's the world where everything is perfectly in tune, you know, one's consciousness is perfectly in tune with Krishna and harmony. So the idea is here is that stick with the prescribed duty. Prabhupada called it the prescribed duty that you have. Even though there may be some discomfort, this is exactly what Arjun needs to do. His prescribed duty is to fight the battle. He's fighting against it. Now that prescribed duty is also, who is prescribed by? It's prescribed by Krishna. So he's the greatest prescriber, the supreme prescriber. If we can find out what Krishna wants of us, and we make the best effort to do that, then our life is nicely situated. And we'll be nicely situated, and we'll progress, you know, in purification. If we fight that, you know, our prescribed duty, we have some other idea, then we'll find ourselves uneasy in the path of Krishna consciousness. So any discussion of this verse? If one transcends the modes of nature and is fully centered in Krishna consciousness, he can perform anything and everything under the guidance of the bona fide spiritual master. Okay. Now here comes this last eight verses, which are all about our real enemy in this world. I always found this part of the Bhagavad Gita very illuminating. Arjuna vacha atakena payukto yam papam charati purushaha anichanna bivashneya balad even yojitaha. Arjuna said, O descendant of Vrishni, by what is one impelled to sinful acts, even unwillingly, as if engaged by force? Purport, a living entity, as part and parcel of the Supreme, is originally spiritual, pure, and free from all material contaminations. Therefore, by nature, he is not subject to the sins of the material world. But when he is in contact with the material nature, he acts in many sinful ways without hesitation, and sometimes even against his will. As such, Arjuna's question to Krishna is very sanguine, meaning very pertinent, as to the perverted nature of the living entities. Although the living entity sometimes does not want to act in sin, he is still forced to act. Sinful actions are not, however, impelled by the supersoul within, but are due to another cause, as the Lord explains in the next verse. So this is, you know, Arjuna is kind of expanding also. It follows nicely from text 35, because Krishna is saying, don't deviate. You know, basically, don't deviate. And the greatest deviation of the living entity against his own interest is to act against the laws of God and the laws of nature. And that's the definition of sin, you know. It's an act, actually, ultimately, against our own best interests. Seemingly, you know, for our own interests, but ultimately against our best interests. And that's our what is it that impels one to act against one's best interests, even knowingly, you know, even like your intelligence may understand, but you act. So that's the question. Shri Bhagavan Uvacha. Kama esha krodha esha rajo guna samudbhavaha mahashano mahapapma vidyenam iha vaidinam. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, "It is lust only, Arjuna, which is born of contact with the material mode of passion and later transformed into wrath, and which is the all-devouring, sinful enemy of this world." Wrath being fury and great anger. Purport. When a living entity comes in contact with the material creation, his eternal love for Krishna is transformed into lust in association with the mode of passion. Or in other words, the sense of love of God becomes transformed into lust as milk in contact with sour tamarind is transformed into yogurt. Then again, when lust is unsatisfied, it turns into wrath. Wrath is transformed into illusion, and illusion continues the material existence. Therefore, lust is the greatest enemy of the living entity, and it is lust only which induces the pure living entity to remain entangled in the material world. Wrath is the manifestation of the mode of ignorance. These modes exhibit themselves as wrath and other corollaries. If, therefore, the mode of passion, instead of being degraded into the mode of ignorance, is elevated to the mode of goodness by the prescribed method of living and acting, then one can be saved from the degradation of wrath by spiritual attachment. The Supreme Personality of God had expanded himself into many for his ever-increasing spiritual bliss, and the living entities are parts and parcels of this spiritual bliss. They also have partial independence. But by misuse of their independence, when the service attitude is transformed into the propensity for sense enjoyment, they come under the sway of lust. This material creation is created by the Lord to give facility to the conditioned souls to fulfill these lustful propensities, and when completely baffled by prolonged lustful activities, the living entities begin to inquire about their real position. This inquiry is the beginning of the Vedanta Sutras, wherein it is said, Atato Brahma Jigyasa. One should inquire into the Supreme. And the Supreme is defined in Srimad Bhagavatam as Janmadyasya Yaton Vayadi Tadatascha, or the origin of everything is the Supreme Brahman. Therefore, the origin of lust is also in the Supreme. If, therefore, lust is transformed into love for the Supreme, or transformed into Krishna consciousness, or in other words, desiring everything for Krishna, then both lust and wrath can be spiritualized. Hanuman, the great servitor of Lord Rama, exhibited his wrath by burning the golden city of Ravana. But by doing so, he became the greatest devotee of the Lord. Here also in the Bhagavad Gita, the Lord induces Arjuna to engage his wrath upon his enemies for the satisfaction of the Lord. Therefore, lust and wrath, when they are employed in Krishna consciousness, become our friends instead of our enemies. So, the real enemy of the living entity is material desire. Now, Prabhupada actually refers to text 61 or 62 in the second chapter, in the beginning of this purport. How does lust arise? Well, in order to get some desire, for desire to arise, one has to perceive the desirable object. That's called dhyana, in a sense. Dhyayato vishayan punksa. When a living entity contemplates a pleasurable object, then attachment awakens. Dhyayato vishayan sangas teshu bhajayate. Sangha is awakened. Sangha meaning attachment. Now, it's very fascinating to me that sangha also means association. So, if we associate in somehow or other, right, through one of the senses, hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting, touching, attachment will grow if the object is one of that can bring us pleasure. So that attachment, when you pursue it, if you continue with it, that turns into kama. Sangat sanjayate kama. Now, inevitably, that kama, as will be explained in this section, is never truly satisfied. It may be satiated for some time, but then it just flares up again, just like a fire. Feeding your material desires is like putting a gasoline into a fire. You know, it flares up. If you pour gasoline on the fire, it may tamp down for a second or two, right? Because it acts like it restricts the oxygen. But the next second, it blows up much worse than before. So, therefore, our material desires can never truly be satisfied. That's why we heard this morning, what is it? Bhukti mukti siddhi kami sakala ashanta. Sakali ashanta. Meaning that those who are desirous, or those who are after material sense gratification, those who are after liberation for themselves, or some mystic cities, they're all in the realm of those who are beset by kama. They may be a little more refined kind of kama, different motive, but it's still material desire. So you can never be peaceful, because you can never have enough. You know, you can never have enough material objects. I was reading how, you know, there's such a disparity now in this society becoming polarized more and more in terms of income. There's an upper crust, 1% or 2%, that have unlimited amounts, hundreds of millions or even billions of dollars. And then there used to be a middle class, but that's like gradually sinking down into the lower class. So you got more and more disparity. So to feed that upper class, you know, those who have unlimited, where money's no object, there's these luxury items, you know, like cars that we can't even imagine, you know, Rolls Royce or more, you know, $100,000, $200,000 cars. Restaurants where you can easily drop $500 to $1,000. You know, it's obscene. But that's what, you know, are they happy? Are the people happier by doing that? What if you can do it one day, but then the next day you can't afford $500, you can only afford $400. And all the people who you used to eat with, they don't want to eat with you anymore because you can only afford $400 instead of $500. It's a big status game, you know. You're never satisfied in that. There's no limit to it. So, and for the poor people, the same thing is there. Just being poor is not inherently virtuous, you know. They dream about all these things. You know, you watch TV and there's all the things you can't buy, you become more frustrated, right? So it inevitably leads to krodha. The kama leads to anger. And if you can't express your anger, you turn inward. You know, classic thing, you get drunk, now you may do some drugs, you know. So it's just frustration. You know, so that's what Prabhupada is referring to. That's right in that verse. Kama krodha vijayate. Right? From the kama comes anger. And what comes from anger? Sammoha. Krodha bhavati sammoha. Prabhupada also makes wrath is transformed into illusion. Sammoha. Become completely bewildered about who you are, how can you become satisfied, what your real goal of life is, who's your friend, who's your enemy, you know, who knows, who among people know that the real enemy is inside, is kama, is their own material desires. Everyone is thinking the person who is frustrating the fulfillment of my desires, that's my enemy, isn't it? And some people are just angry, and if they don't have an enemy, they'll create one. So that they, you know, it's madness. It comes down to madness. It comes down. Nunam pramatta kukura devi karma. As Rishabhdev says, it's Krishna. Nunam pramatta kukura devi karma yedindriya pita yavana. That those who are absorbed day and night, a large percentage of the people in the world, absorbed day and night in fulfilling the desires of their senses or trying to escape, you know, the results of their sinful activities, are certainly mad. In this word, nunam pramatta, the same word, pramatta, extremely mad or intoxicated, bewildered, however you want to call it. So that's the situation. Now the idea that this is the enemy, and he says all devouring, well of course the living entity can't be devoured in truth, right? We always survive, whatever happens. But devoured here means you're swallowed up by the material energy so that you're completely bewildered. And it goes on and on, life after life. You know, this human form of life is so rare. We've spent most of our time in this world in the subhuman species. Makes sense, right? I mean, there's 8 million of them. There's only 400,000 human species. And so now we have this rare human life. But, you know, it's for the most part, it's being wasted in the animal propensities. So this is what forces people to do things, even if they happen to know what's good for them. So once you get that fire burning, you know, the fire of lust, it overwhelms your intelligence. That will be explained in the next couple of verses. So the idea in yoga is to, as Prabhupada explains here, but one thing to understand, that kama, material desire, is simply pure love of God transformed into kama. Kama and prema are like mirror images. Kama is completely focused on your own gratification. Prema is completely focused on Krishna's gratification. Krishna's Kaviraj says, Atmandriya Pradivanchi Bhogavancha Kama. Yeah, that Atmandriya Pradivanchi, the desire to satisfy one's own senses is called kama. The desire to satisfy Krishna's senses is called prema. They look similar, you know. They involve a strong desire. So it's just like iron and gold. Kama is like iron, prema is like gold. Well, what do they share? Well, they're both metals, you know. But one is worth hardly, not much, and one is very, very valuable. So the trick, the idea is to try to transform or revive, purify the kama back into prema. That's what we're doing. And we're not suppressing. Just like, you know, in Krishna consciousness, there's so many things to do for the senses, right? Well, the senses, as will be explained here, are the repository of this lust. The eyes have a certain set of things you want to see. The ears want to hear nice cinema songs, Prabhupada would say, you know, pop music, rock music, whatever your taste is. Something, anything to do with, that doesn't have to do with Krishna. You know, something popular. The other senses all have their sense objects, obviously. So the desires are there, even in the senses. You know, and the mind, but to speak of the mind, you know, I mean, you can only have so much activity with the senses, but the mind can go wild. You can imagine so many things, novels, video games, everything. It's all in the mind. You know, that's a big repository. And even the intelligence can be lusty. Always thinking, planning, you know, how to get more of this and enjoy this. So those things have to be purified. And if you notice, Krishna consciousness is a whole lifestyle. Everything is involved. All the senses, you know, the mind, the intelligence, the active senses, knowledge-acquiring senses, everything can be engaged. And in doing so, that lust is gradually transformed back into prema. And you can tell if you're progressing because you're becoming less attracted to the material thing. How do I know I'm advancing? You're becoming less attracted to material, more attracted to Krishna. Simple. If you're not, then you're doing something wrong. And the key of the whole thing is the chanting of the holy name. That's immediate. It's something that we can have at any time and any place. At any time we can chant Hare Krishna. Think of Krishna through that sound and immediately be attracted to Krishna and, you know, the purification is going on. So that's, how does this begin? Well, Prabhupada talks here about the Vedanta Sutra. He's talking about that the relationship between that world and this world. So there has to be lust, or something that appears to be lust in the spiritual world. And you say, okay, there's, you know, Radha and Krishna. But it's pure. The highest in that world is the lowest in this world. You know, so adulterous affairs here are very abominable, really. Whereas there, they're the worshipable, most worshipable thing. The great sannyasi, Lord Chaitanya, you know, he worshipped the relation between Radha and Krishna. Well, you know, objectively speaking, it's an adulterous affair. But it's most worshipable. Because it displays the most intense loving relationship between Krishna's pure servitor and Krishna himself. That's the criterion, you know. Because it's Krishna who's the object of it, therefore it's pure. It can't be impure. But in this plane, it's the manifestation of kama, and it's very degrading and contaminating and causes great suffering. So there's the process of going from lust back to prema is a long one. It involves discipline and everything. And here, this knowledge that's explained at the end of this chapter, I found very illuminating, helping us along. Any questions on this particular verse? A discussion. Mahapapma, greatly sinful. Yeah.
At what point can a living entity, a living entity whose intelligence is covered by the lust, at what point can this living entity actually see that and actually realize that the intelligence is covered by the lust? Because, I mean, it's like Mahat said once, if Krishna himself came to a person like that and said, you know, something, the person wouldn't be able to register because the intelligence is contaminated. So can a living entity actually trim?
Well, first of all, the example is there when Krishna appeared. You know, as Prabhupada explains, hardly anyone understood that he was actually the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And we're reading, you know, you read Krishna book and there's all these demons. They're trying to fight Krishna. You know, that's not very smart. I mean, he's God, right? We just read Dhenukasura, right? So Dhenukasura is the biggest, baddest donkey, right? Big demon, you know? And he was already killed by Balaram. But here you have these other stupid Dhenukas. They still come, and it happens all the time. The wrestlers came running, you know, to try to avenge Chanur and Mushtika. Isn't it obvious? You know, they look like little boys, but they're very special. But no, you know, the anger overwhelms the intelligence. So it's exactly like that. And, you know, in the more Duryodhana and the others, they still didn't see Krishna for what he was, precisely because their awareness intelligence was covered over. So this is where the intervention of the representative of Krishna is so important. Because you try some means, some way or other, to interest the person in the science of Krishna, in the ideas. Just like, you know, book distribution, what are you trying to do? You're trying to give people a chance to read where the intelligence, because the intelligence, you know, as Krishna explained, the modes of nature, they sometimes they're, you know, deeply in the mode of passion or ignorance, but sometimes the mode of goodness comes, even people who are mostly mode of passion or ignorance. So in that mode of goodness, you may say, well, someone is sitting down to read. Now, I must say they're sitting down to read garbage, but if they're sitting down to read Bhagavad Gita, then that knowledge may you know, filter in, the light may go off, and the questioning, the inquiry may awaken. Whoa, what's going on? What's this all about? Now, to sit down and read Bhagavad Gita means to have a lot of questions, you know, and all the Sanskrit and everything. That's okay. But the idea is that it gets through. Krishna gets through, you know, breaks through. The light breaks through the cloud, you know, and something happens inside, and the soul awakens a little bit. And if that awakening then brings the person to inquire further, keep turning the pages, and ultimately to visit a temple, then that's how it works. So basically it boils down to the mercy of this a great acharya like Srila Prabhupada, or anyone, you know. The idea is that this is why Krishna comes, you know. He comes in order to reestablish Dharma. What does that mean? Well, it means in order to speak Bhagavad Gita, and in order to enact his pastimes, in order to empower others to carry on and preach, just like he, you know, empowered Vyasadeva and Sudha Goswami, Shukadeva. They're all carrying it on in the Bhagavatam and down to the present day. So that's how the clouds can lift. It's a difficult process because people really, really are used to being within the modes and within that you know, aura of sense gratification. And as you know from personal experience, it's hard to break through that, you know. But it is possible. And that's what, you know, the Sankirtan movement is all about. Yeah, in the guise, you know, of coming to enjoy. It's like this, like the Rath Yatra, you know, festival we just had in L.A. So, to many people who come, they come to enjoy. They're not coming there because they're spontaneously attracted to serve Jagannath, you know. Some are. But basically, they're coming to enjoy. It's dancing, it's free food, you know, you got a stage show, you know, and all this. That's cool. But in the process of doing that, they're coming in contact with the holy name, with the books, with Jagannath himself, with prasadam, with devotees. And that interest, that attraction, which is you know, it's not completely pure, obviously, but there's an element of purity in it, can ultimately bring them to, you know, take up the process, you know, of chanting and becoming serious. So this is how it works. Basically, it's through sangha that we get entangled, and it's through satsanga, you know, that we can get liberated. It's a, you know, it's planting the seeds. I like to call it this Johnny Appleseed. Does anyone ever hear of Johnny Appleseed? You know, I read up on Johnny Appleseed one time. He was like a sannyasi. He's a real figure. You know, he wasn't a mythical figure. I think he lived in Massachusetts or something like that, Rhode Island. This was in the early 19th century. And his wife died. And he was bereft, you know. But he was a pious guy, and he decided to dedicate his life to planting apple trees around the country. And he actually went out and he started throwing seeds everywhere. New York State, upper New York State, a lot of apples up there. I don't know if you ever, same thing, you know. A lot of the seeds, you know, didn't fructify. But then when they, in the Northwest, you know, Washington State. And it was very, it's very, you know, he sacrificed. He's just like walking around. That was his dharma. That was his charity. And it's very pious, you know, to plant fruit trees. You know, so he got a lot of credit for that. But preaching is like that also, you know, teaching Krishna consciousness. You're throwing out a lot of seeds. And some find, you know, fall on the rocks, you know. And nobody reads the books, nobody responds. It's like Prabhupada the first year, you know, he's like crying in the wilderness, is described. I think there's a chapter like that in the Lilamrita, crying in the wilderness. Going here, there, trying to find a willing ear, you know, an open heart, you know. But then those seeds started to fructify. And the tree, you know, the tree of ISKCON, which is a big branch, actually, of the Chaitanya tree, started growing. Because when you have, you know, the seed is growing in people's hearts, then they in turn are able to become effective seed planters also of Krishna consciousness. So that's it takes time, but it can happen. Someone's intelligence can become turned, as we see. All right, should we do another one? The different degrees of this lust. Dume navrete vanni. Yatadarsho malenacha. Yatolbe navrito garbhas. Tatate nedam avritam. As fire is covered by smoke, as a mirror is covered by dust, or as the embryo is covered by the womb, the living entity is similarly covered by different degrees of this lust. Purport. There are three degrees of covering of the living entity by which his pure consciousness is obscured. This covering is but lust under different manifestations, like smoke in the fire, dust on the mirror, and the womb about the embryo. When lust is compared to smoke, it is understood that the fire of the living spark can be a little perceived. In other words, when the living entity exhibits his Krishna consciousness slightly, he may be likened to the fire covered by smoke. Although fire is necessary where there is smoke, there is no overt manifestation of fire in the early stage. This stage is like the beginning of Krishna consciousness. The dust on the mirror refers to a cleansing process of the mirror of the mind by so many spiritual methods. The best process is to chant the holy names of the Lord. The embryo covered by the womb is an analogy illustrating a helpless position, for the child in the womb is so helpless that he cannot even move. This stage of living condition can be compared to that of the trees. The trees are also living entities, but they have been put in such a condition of life by such a great exhibition of lust that they are almost void of all consciousness. The covered mirror is compared to the birds and beasts, and the smoke-covered fire is compared to the human being. In the form of a human being, the living entity may revive a little Krishna consciousness, and if he makes further development, the fire of spiritual life can be kindled in the human form of life. By careful handling of the smoke in the fire, fire can be made to blaze. Therefore, the human form of life is a chance for the living entity to escape the entanglement of material existence. In the human form of life, one can conquer the enemy, lust, by cultivation of Krishna consciousness under able guidance. So this is the different degrees of this lust. And as explained here, the human form of life is a great opportunity because, as explained, you know, if you go to school, and everyone goes to school, right? So you may do so many other things, so many other desires, but when you're in school and you're studying, then you're receiving knowledge through books, through instruction. And your consciousness is being transformed. Now, mostly it's being transformed materially, but you're learning something that will help you to live in this world. So in everybody's human being's life, you know, there are periods of receptivity where you can be purified, and that's a chance for this for the fire to grow. Just like we say, someone's in the fire; he's fired up, you know, in Krishna consciousness. It means that there's enthusiasm there, you know, and progress is being made. So, associating with those who can fire you up, you know, is essential. That's where this, the pure devotee comes in. You know, the pure devotee is on fire. Prabhupada likes to use this analogy of the iron rod in the fire. You know, so Krishna is the fire, and our consciousness is the iron. You know, material life, it's iron, dull. You know, it's all in matter, you know. But as soon as we start thinking of Krishna, primarily through the holy name, then we're in the fire. And the more that we keep that iron rod of our consciousness in the fire, the more we'll begin to resemble the fire. In other words, we'll get purified and be able to then pass the fire on to others. So that opportunity is here in the human form of life. And others are so covered over that it's not possible. Like you look at the life of animals, you know, or insects. I mean, there's no possibility, there's no thought there. You know, it's all just eating or fighting or mating. You know, and dying. You know, it's like the famous praying mantis. You know, after sex, then the female eats the male. Yeah, and at least some species that do that. So, not a very happy form of life. You know, but there's so many like that. You know, just, what are the animals doing? You know, I had a friend who had a fish tank for a long time, Elantra. And, you know, these fish, he had tropical fish, and very colorful, it's like inside. Such a trouble to take care of that thing, finally got rid of it. But, you know, the fish are going back and then forth. Back. And have you ever watched, you know? All day, that's all they do. Because their consciousness is so covered that it's a new experience for them. They just visited over there, but they forgot it was over there. So they go over here, back again. And then when the feeding comes, you know, he puts a little feed in, oh, you know, they all run up there to the... What a life, huh? But that's a conscious being. You know, they can't become Krishna conscious. They can't learn anything. It's just eating and swimming. Back and forth. Back and forth. You know, it's tragic, really. And all of nature is like that. The hard struggle for existence. Somehow to keep the body together, you know, a little sex, and then, you know, exhaustion, and then protect from enemies. Eating, sleeping, mating, defending, that's it. So human form of life is a juncture, a junction, if you will, by which we can get out of this trap we've gotten ourselves into, of identifying with the body, the senses, looking for some gratification, trying to survive, and then dying. You know, that's such a tragedy for the soul, which is really part and parcel of God. We're divine. All of us are divine beings. And to fall down into this situation, you know. So we should struggle very hard to get this fire going so that the smoke won't cover us anymore. And we'll actually be enlightened, you know. And the light will be blazing. That's why you see, you know, even in the West, you see they paint the halo. You know, the enlightened beings are light, is light. You know, they've seen the light. Om jnana tamarandasya jnana shalakaya chakshu unmitamena tasmai shri guruve namah. So we're born in the darkness, blind. Yeah, jnana, timarandasya means blinded by ignorance and darkness. Timar is tamasya. So, but the spiritual master, you know, with like the instrument, the medical instrument, you know, he pries open the eyes and he applies the ointment of knowledge. That's what it means, actually. Jnananjana shalakya. So the shalakya is the instrument, and jnananjana is the ointment of knowledge. Jnananjana shalakya, chakshu unmitam. He opened the eyes, literally opened the eyes. And I offer my obeisance to him. So what a blessing that is. The greatest blessing is knowledge. And not just any knowledge, but that knowledge by which one can make one's life perfect. What could be a greater blessing than that? You may teach someone, like the classic thing, you can give someone food, but if you teach them how to grow their own food, then you're really giving something. You know what I'm saying? So we should take advantage. The point is to take advantage of this. And if you act on it, then it becomes just like nectar. When you read the Bhagavad Gita, you know, it's, you know, Krishna is giving you more attraction for him in all ways, and including the Bhagavad Gita. It's like nectar for the intelligence. The intelligence can also enjoy like anything, you know, to hear, to read these books, and chant these verses. Okay, we have time for one more. Avitam gana metena.
Avitam gana metena.
Gani no nitya vaidina.
Gani no nitya vaidina.
Kama rupena
konteya. Kama rupena
konteya. Dushpure nanalena cha. Thus, the wise living entity's pure consciousness becomes covered by his eternal enemy in the form of lust, which is never satisfied and which burns like fire. Purport. It is said in the Manusmriti that lust cannot be satisfied by any amount of sense enjoyment. Just as fire is never extinguished by a constant supply of fuel. In the material world, the center of all activities is sex, and thus this material world is called the Maitunya Agara, or the shackles of sex life. In the ordinary prison house, criminals are kept within bars. Similarly, the criminals who are disobedient to the laws of the Lord are shackled by sex life. Advancement of material civilization on the basis of sense gratification means increasing the duration of the material existence of a living entity. Therefore, this lust is the symbol of ignorance by which the living entity is kept within the material world. While one enjoys sense gratification, it may be that there is some feeling of happiness, but actually that so-called feeling of happiness is the ultimate enemy of the sense enjoyer. This is a famous sentence worth remembering. There is some happiness in sense gratification. No one can deny it. But that sense of happiness is our ultimate enemy. Now, it's really scary, because if you don't understand, you don't have any experience or believe in, say, have faith in, that there's another platform of happiness, then you're kind of caught in a catch-22. Because you can't just live without enjoying anything, right? So if the only enjoyment you know about is sense gratification, but that sense gratification is your source of misery, then you're in a trap. And that's exactly what the material world is. It's a trap or a fort or a prison house. And the prison house is this enjoying mood. Maya is very expert at convincing us that there's gold at the end of the rainbow, you know. That if we just try this combination, if I just go here, this person, that person, somehow or other, then I'll really enjoy, I'll find my platform in heaven. But it's never to be. Even if you do get what you dream about, you'll find that it's not the source of the happiness you dreamt about. And that snake is always coming at you. You know, can you really be happy and peaceful if there's some poisonous snake, you know, crawling up it? You know it's coming. You know, it's 5 minutes away. Because, you know, there's a big cobra on its way here, and it's 5 minutes away. All right, that's good. Let's have a little cup of tea. You know, we have 5 minutes. You know, can you really be peaceful and happy? That poisonous snake is time. Can you see who's there out there? We should kind of be quiet. And so, therefore, Uddhava prays. He says, he says, Dashtam janam sampatitam bilesmin. Kalahina chuddisukoda tarsham. So he's saying, I'm being bitten by the snake. Dashtam janam sampatitam. I've fallen into the snake hole of this material world. Okay? And I'm being bitten by the poisonous snake of time. Kalahina. And yet, he paints this picture. Chudra sukoru tarsham. Let's see what that means. It means, I have uru tarsha, a great thirst, a great desire for insignificant pleasures of this world. Now this is precisely what I just described. You fall into a well where you know there's poisonous snakes. But okay, they're a little bit farther in the other corner of the hole. You have a few minutes, and in these few minutes you can enjoy, like tic-tac-toe or something, or, you know, eat something. And I'll try to forget about the snake. It's coming to get me. That's exactly the situation. Kala hina. The poisonous snake of time. Krishna says, Kalosmi, I am that time. I've come to destroy you all. Your bodies are going to be destroyed, you know. So what is Uddhava's prayer? He says, Samudharayanam kripayabhavarga vichobarasincha mahanubhava. He's speaking to Krishna. Uddhava Gita, Bhagavad Gita, they're similar. So he's saying to Krishna directly, My dear Lord, O Great One, Mahanubhava, please lift me up out of this hole, this snake hole. Samudharayanam kripayabhavarga vichobarasincha, by sprinkling upon me your nectarian words, which are bring about liberation, which will liberate me from this trap. It's a great prayer, you know. Right? We just read it last month. It's in, it says 11th canon. So, kripayapavarga, which are out of, you speak out of your mercy and which bring out liberation. So this is a great prayer. It's good for the Bhagavad Gita. We're in this hole, this snake hole. We think it's very nice, you know, San Diego, where, you know, I got my little situation. But the snake is coming. He's got you. Kalahina, snake of time. So the only way out is taking these words seriously, Krishna's words seriously. He's speaking them out of his compassion for us. And if we can get to that position beyond time. Time means measuring change. It's the world of birth and death. So, okay, so to get beyond time, we have to transcend the modes and change. And that means liberation at the lotus feet of Krishna in the spiritual world. All glories to Shiva.